Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to the show. This week's podcast is sponsored by RSA Security and hosted by the gang at Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. We have a nifty little VMware image all to ourselves, thanks to them. This week's show is a monster. We'll be chatting to Mark Dowd about his seminal paper on null pointer dereferencing vulnerabilities. There's been a lot of talk around Mark's work on a flash vulnerability and the resulting 25-page paper all about that class of vulnerability. He'll be along soon to discuss it. We'll also have a chat to Simon Howard. He's one of the duo behind the Race to Zero Virus Obfuscation Challenge due to take place at DEF CON this August. The idea behind the competition is to show just how broken antivirus software is. And not surprisingly, the AV companies aren't happy. We'll also be joined by Greg Singh from RSA for this week's sponsor interview, which is all about data loss prevention, or DLP. Now, if I were the IT security equivalent of Alan Jones or Bill O'Reilly, I'd probably say DLP's been given a rough trot by the latte-sipping security elites. It's been described as a technology to prevent attackers and insiders alike from transferring valuable corporate information outside of a company's network, where in actual fact, DLP is designed to prevent accidental data leakage. That's in our sponsor interview, and it's coming up later. But first, as always, it's time for this week's news headlines with ZDNet Australia's Munir Kataria. And Munir, we're going to start this week's news with what is possibly the cheesiest security headline I've seen all year.
Thanks for that.
Which I'm reliably informed you came up with, which is Olympic Trojan horse jumping trials have begun.
Come on, it's a great one.
Takada takada boom tsh. I love it. It's fantastic. But can you explain the crux of the story for our listeners, please?
The story is that within the last 6 months, Message Labs says they've found at least 13 new Trojan horses, which, basically are using the Olympics to try and infect people.
Giddy up. It's digital equestrian, is that right?
Yeah, that's the one.
I got the joke. But okay. There you go. So, yeah, big surprise there that the bad guys are exploiting interest in the Olympics.
Yeah, that's right. And there's been 13 so far, and obviously I think there's going to be an awful lot more over the next few months.
Well, if they do it for Valentine's Day, they're going to do it for the Olympics, aren't they?
Well, you know it. And it was a damn good headline.
Yes, it was. Well done. Now, ZDNet contributor Brett Winterford, he's done a great write-up on Cyberstorm 2, and apparently the lesson learned from Cyberstorm 2 is that communication between the public sector and commercial enterprise needs to be improved.
Yeah, Cyberstorm 2, for those people who are listening who don't know what it is, it's when Australian companies and government organisations all got together and to test their IT systems against the cyber warfare attacks. And what they discovered from the attacks was that their technical and their IT systems were okay, but it was the communication between all of those companies and organizations which was rubbish, basically, so they needed to fix that.
Well, not entirely a huge surprise there, but one thing that I think is genuinely hilarious is that they likened the attack, excuse me, they likened the attack to the script of Die Hard 4,
that's right.
Which I think is just hilarious that they're actually taking cues from Hollywood. I mean, it's life imitating art, if ever I've seen it.
Yeah, that was quite funny. You just expect Bruce Willis to turn up at any moment and fix it.
Now, the websites of the UN and some UK government sites have been done by drive-by sort of JavaScript injection attacks.
That's right, yeah. WebSensor has been talking about this. They're saying that there were massive JavaScript injection attacks and the UN and the UK government websites, and they seem to be related as well, using the same tool.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, mate, is over the weekend on various lists I've heard talk that up to 500,000 Windows IIS boxes have been hosed.
Oh, wow.
It's actually a vulnerability in the applications running on top of the server, so it's not actually Microsoft's fault, this one, but it looks like, yeah, up to 500,000 boxes have been completely pwned, which is, you know, it's a lot of boxes. The internet is just more and more every day a more dangerous neighborhood.
So it seems to be, which is why we're so in the right business.
Yeah, happy days, you know, it'd be good if you could...
Happy about all of these attacks at all. No, bad.
Security people don't get happy when there's mayhem. But look, it is pretty bad. I mean, it's just kind of a shit thing when you've been in the business for this long and you've been warning that, you know, it could get really bad. And then, just because everyone had a firewall meant that, you know, everyone could see the attacks shifting towards the client. And,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just, it's pretty dodgy out there.
It's looking, and we're hearing more and more about these JavaScript injections. I think we've spoken about them every single week for months now.
Yeah, it's pretty nasty stuff. Anyway, moving on, and apparently Chinese hackers were able to disable CNN.com for 3 hours.
This was really interesting because this was the weekend before, when we heard from the Chinese hackers that, you know, they were going to try attacking CNN.com with a DDoS attack. And then at the last second, they said, actually, no, we're not going to do it. And then they ended up knocking them out for 3 hours anyway. But it's the way that they've done it, which is brilliant, don't you think?
Well, encouraging people to download what is effectively malware and install it on their own system. So they've become voluntarily associated with this botnet that attacked CNN, which
is a whole new way. I mean, talk about activism. That's the word I was thinking of.
I can't believe we're using that word. Hang your head in shame.
So what they've done is, instead of going and standing outside the embassy and protesting, what you do is you download this little bit of malware, well, effectively it is malware, and then you point it at the website and it automatically attacks it. So you know you've recruited and showing your allegiance by
downloading. Well, yeah, and you've shown that you're a groovy, politically active type. But the whole reason people go to protest is to get laid, and you can't do that by installing a bit of malware on your computer.
Do they really?
You were never politically active.
God, I will be now.
I mean, yeah, baby, I'm all about those land rights for gay whales. Totally. What are you studying again?
Oh, jeez. No, I didn't realize this. This is all... Oh, okay.
But it's difficult to do that by installing a little, attack bit of software on your computer. I think that's not really the same thing.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I guess so.
But I wonder, you know, everyone says, oh, a group of Chinese hackers said that they were going to attack CNN. But I don't know. It just seems that lately everyone loves to pin everything on China. I mean, if I wanted to hack into, if I wanted to get into some defense installation, I mean, I'm not gonna use an Australian IP, am I? I'm gonna use a Chinese IP.
You are, no, for sure.
Because that way you can just get away with it. Well, exactly. And there's heaps of vulnerable boxes in China.
Yeah.
Cooperating, you know, cross-border, cross-language with Chinese authorities is going to be a real pain in the ass. Western authorities aren't going to believe anything that they say anyway. So even if they say, oh, well, that was just a university box that got compromised by some hacker from, you know, that was bounced through some other box in Belgium, they're still not going to believe you. So China has become the ultimate patsy for getting away with murder. I mean, you could hack anyone from China and people will go, oh, yeah, it was Chinese hackers.
It's just the Chinese. And now there are billions of them. It's fine.
Anyway. So there you go. That's grumble, grumble, grumble. Now, here we go. We've got completely meaningless statistic from a vendor. I just love these, which is, where did this one come from? Sophos. One web page is infected every 5 seconds, apparently.
That's right. And every day, 12 companies release figures that have been completely pulled out of their ass.
There we go.
Yeah.
But, you know, I liken this to just, you know, completely... Why is it that malware companies just love putting out completely useless information? It can be fun sometimes, but you know what else could they come up with? You know, I mean, when you eat an orange, how much citrus oil do you ingest? How long does it take to start a 2-liter Nissan SR20 DET engine when the air temperature is 70 degrees? I mean, you know, how much esoteric information can these guys come up with?
Well, do you know what they're doing? They're listening to this show. They're hearing about our drive-by attacks every single week and thinking, damn, we need to get on that boat. And, you know, so they release a whole lot of stats to go with it.
We need to quantify precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I get it. It's our fault. Right. All right, now, we're done with that anyway. Now, moving on, Bluetooth is Howard Schmidt, who's actually been a guest on this program. He was the former White House cybersecurity advisor. Reckons Bluetooth is a pile of crap, and, well, I mean, it's hard to disagree with him. It's been vulnerable for years.
There has. I remember, this is going back just over 4 years ago, speaking to Adam Laurie, who's been quoted in this actual story, and he's there saying, you know, that the protocols are being used outside of the specifications for which they were originally intended. And every time, Schmid said that the way that the protocols interact with each other, they introduce security holes. I remember 4 or 5 years ago going into this Adam Laurie's office with a whole bag of mobile phones, and all of them had their Bluetooth turned on. Some of them were invisible, some weren't. And he just sat there with his Linux laptop and pulled out photographs, text messages, contacts, all sorts of stuff, without me taking the phones out of the carrier bag. It was quite an incredible experience. Really opened my eyes then.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's not really a lot more that can be done. What was his name? Ollie Whitehouse did, was that his name? Whitehouse? I think it was anyway. He was from AtStake, but he was based in Melbourne. Back, you know, before AtStake got sold to Symantec, of course.
Yep.
He was for some reason, he worked in Melbourne. Anyway, for an American company. Very weird. But he was an expert on Bluetooth, did a presentation to RuxCod several years ago, and, you know, Bluetooth is fundamentally flawed. It's not like there's just been a couple of bugs in it that people have patched up. Mm. The protocol itself is completely balked. So Schmidt's onto something here when he says, well, hey, you know, Bluetooth has been compromised, and we've been saying this for years, but yet everyone's sort of gone back to business as normal. They've just sort of buried their heads in the sand and decided to ignore it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real big deal about 4 years ago. And then Nokia and whatever and the other people said, yeah, you know, we've improved our phones now and improved the security, so you're all fine now. And then it kind of like disappeared off the agenda. But hopefully now it's coming back and people are going to take it a bit more seriously. Do you use Bluetooth?
No, actually. I mean, I use it for my keyboard. I've got a Bluetooth keyboard, but I mean, I've got it on the old mobile phone and that stays well and truly switched off all the time. I keep it switched off on my laptop as well. My home PC, I use it, but nothing that goes into a shared environment. Forget it.
Yeah. I find my phones, I keep it off mainly because of battery. You know, if anything else, that keeps me secure. Is I'm just worried about battery life, and so I keep the Bluetooth off and only put it on when I want to. But this kind of thing makes you realize that's probably good practice.
And who wants blue teeth anyway? That's what I want to know.
After saying that, you can't moan about my headline, all right?
Yeah, yeah, true. Okay, bad pun. We're even. Now, in our final news story, Gartner reckons that security spending has hit $10 billion. Is that US? Yeah, that's US, isn't it? US $10.5 billion worldwide this year, which is great.
Right.
And,
up.
You know, I think all security companies who are vying for this rapidly expanding marketplace should buy as many ads as possible in ZDNet and Risky Business.
I agree with you.
Because it's the only way that you're actually going to exceed, what does it say, $13.1 billion in 2012.
That's right. They say it's gone up 11.2% in 2007. So, I mean, it's increasing at a pretty decent rate there.
Yeah, and as George Bush said, it's going to make the pie higher. That was his metaphor. So there's another $2.6 billion about to be tacked onto that $10.5 billion figure, up to $13.1 in 2012.
We need higher pies. That's great.
We need higher pies. That's right. And is our children learning? I love those Bush quotes. But yeah, the pie, the security pie is getting higher.
It's the one about fish and humans living together peacefully, which is my favorite.
That's pretty good, yeah. Yeah, now, one thing that's a little bit interesting here is that they're Ruggero Contu, mm-hmm. who's Gartner's principal research analyst, says that not only are companies realizing they need to be more open in terms of connectivity with business partners and third-party companies, but the SMEs are finally coming to the party and realizing that they need to secure their shiznit.
Yeah, well, I mean, how long have we been talking about this kind of stuff? And we always say, you know, the big companies are all secure. Well, they're not really, but still, at least they seem to know what they're doing.
They spend a lot of money on kit.
Well, yeah, and more it seems. And the smaller ones just install Norton antivirus and think they're fine.
Yeah.
And so now, finally, it seems that they're probably getting their act together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's all happy days. But, you know, one thing that I think is interesting about this report, though, is that they say it's grown 11.2% over last year and that it's going to, you know, grow a lot further to 2012. But, you know, the global financial markets are in turmoil.
Yeah.
It looks like we're heading for a recession in the United States, and that is going to seriously dent any potential growth in the security market. I mean, it's, you know.
Absolutely. All of these analyst figures, they're always good as long as everything stays equal. But as soon as you have a little change in the economy, then everything goes out the window.
Subprime. Yeah, we could be seeing some trouble there. But that takes us to the end of the news. And thank you very much for joining us again this week on Risky Business.
You're very welcome. Look forward to next week.
ZDNet Australia's Mania Katadia there. And you can read all of those stories at zdnet.com.au/news. Up next is our interview with Simon Howard. Since announcing the Race to Zero competition at DEF CON last Friday, Simon's been stunned by the reaction. The tech media has been all over the story, and several CNetNews.com readers have even likened Simon and his fellow organiser, Richard Smith, to terrorists. So what have the pair done to attract this sort of crazy criticism? Well, Race to Zero is an open competition at DEF CON designed to prove that signature-based antivirus solutions are fundamentally flawed. Contestants must take known viruses and modify them to evade detection by standard antivirus solutions. Awards will be given for most elegant obfuscation, dirtiest hack of an obfuscation, comedy value, and most deserving of a beer. In other words, it sounds like a fun afternoon, and there's potential for beer. Hooray for Simon! But when the contest was announced on Friday, the antivirus vendors began whinging immediately. Paul Ferguson, a researcher with antivirus vendor Trend Micro, told CNetsNews.com that responsible disclosure is one thing, but now actually encouraging people to do this as a contest is a little over the top. And he also said that it would do more harm than good. Well, joining us to discuss the competition and to defend his position is Simon Howard, one of the organisers of the Race to Zero competition at DEF CON 2008.
Well, I was at a security conference in Vienna with speaking there about breaking corporate email filtering software.
Yeah, I think I've seen that talk.
Yeah. And got together with another friend after that, and he had an idea that we should do the same kind of thing for antivirus software and just see how good it really is.
Yeah, well, this is what's actually I found pretty interesting is what you guys are proposing isn't actually that radical. It's more like something you do over a few beers for shits and giggles.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden you're being told you're cyber terrorists.
Yeah, and that's what the Stormworm creators are doing every day. Really, they're modifying their code and then sending it back out again, and it's not been detected, and the AV vendors are playing catch up with their signature based AV.
It seems an odd argument, doesn't it, to have the AV vendors saying, jumping up and down and saying, you can't exploit this weakness in our product. That's not fair. It seems very counter to the general principles of security, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're just pointing out the basic flaw in signature-based AV, and that it's pretty much dead, and you need to look at other means of detecting these threats, like heuristic or statistical or behavior-based techniques, or even something like the Bit9 product who do known good applications on your system, and anything else that comes along that it doesn't fit in with those schemes is denied, basically.
Yeah, whitelist.
So we need to think about the larger picture here for controlling antivirus when signature-based just isn't really cutting the mustard anymore.
So I noticed that it's been picked up by News.com, PC World, and a couple of days ago it got picked up by Slashdot as well. So this has created a huge storm. Did you anticipate this much coverage?
I didn't really anticipate this much. I knew that sort of some people would pick it up and put a negative spin on it and think, oh, they're just going to release all these viruses, when in essence we're not going to release any of these samples into the wild. We'll give them to the antivirus vendors to see what's happened, and they can get an overview of the competition as well. So it'll help them in a way. But yeah, we didn't realise that it was going to get this much media attention, really.
Well, I've got to say, I went to the Race to Zero website, and the whole thing seemed loaded with humour. I mean, from my point of view, I mean, I saw there was a sample virus string, you know, and it was almost like a cartoon of what contestants will do. They'll take a sample virus string, you know, swap two letters around and see if it gets past the gateways. And now, am I right in assuming that that was kind of a bit of a joke there, that all you'd have to really do is swap a couple of bits around?
I wanted to make it as simple as possible, the idea of what was happening and what, so that anyone coming to the site, particularly any media people that want to write a story on it, could look at it and say, so this is all they're doing? Is this all you need to do to get past antivirus software? Yeah, so it was a bit of tongue-in-cheek in there.
Yeah, no, I thought I detected that. What do you think makes the antivirus vendors think that the bad guys aren't doing this sort of thing? Why is it that they seem to think that it's, you know, if you guys leave it alone, then no one else is going to do it?
I just don't think they want the general populace to realise this, and that's why they sort of immediately when they see any of it, they put a bad or negative spin on it, saying, oh, what are you doing this for? When in reality, they must know that this is what the cyber criminals are doing.
So really, you are just trying to prove that, you know, malware filtering, signature-based detection is dead, aren't you? I mean, that's the crux of it.
Exactly. That's
and
what we want.
I suppose that would make the makers of signature-based detection, you know, unhappy.
Yeah, this is their bread and butter. And I can't really believe they're still making money on this stuff. For example, you see a new antivirus pattern's released, and then you notice that it's detecting a whole lot of viruses on your machine. Well, in actual fact, you were infected with these viruses months ago, and the antivirus vendors are just caught up and only just detecting the threats now.
But the sad truth is, if you don't use antivirus, you're doubly f***ed, aren't you?
Yeah, it is still a good thing to have antivirus software on there. Don't get me wrong, it's not, but it's not a panacea.
Yeah.
The idea I'm getting across. Just look at alternative antivirus products out there, because there are a few that do sandboxing and actually run the code in an environment first to see if it's good or bad or a little bit dodgy.
To see if it's naughty or nice.
Yeah, exactly.
All right,
so yeah, you just need to do a bit more research and don't just say, oh, the big five vendors, they must be, know what they're doing, they must be good, because chances are they're not.
Are you going to make up some medals or?
Yeah, well, we're hoping to get a bit of sponsorship and get some prizes there. Maybe yeah. Some antivirus industries would like to sponsor us. Yeah, come to the party.
Okay, mate. Well, best of luck with it. And I hope in the meantime that, you know, the New Zealand's intelligence organisations don't pick you up. Have you read any of the comments that have been flying around on that news.com piece?
Yeah. There's some great comments on Slashdot. I wouldn't worry about the news.com or PC World comments, but on Slashdot there's some really good constructive criticism and just people saying, hey, this is a great idea.
And
one interesting thing, guy from Offensive Computing flicked me an email and he posted on his blog as well, was saying that antivirus vendors should send their analysts, their best analysts, along to DEF CON, and then we'll have a race to see their signature development against the people creating the obfuscated viruses.
That's not a bad idea.
See who can do the best job or who can be as quick as the other guys.
That'd be like, that's way too Hollywood though, because then it sounds like a hacker war and then you're going to get CNN there and then it's all over.
Virus writers versus antivirus company.
Yeah, sounds like fun. Okay, Simon, well, thanks a lot for your time and thanks for coming on to Risky Business.
Cool. Cheers, mate.
Simon Howard there on the line from the land of the long white cloud. Hey, bro. Next up, it's time to have a chat with Mark Dowd. Now, Mark's a well-known security researcher. He even found a remote route in Sendmail as recently as 2006, which is a hell of an achievement on its own. But Mark's more recent work in null pointer dereferencing vulnerabilities has the security research community all a-twitter. Mark took a null pointer bug in Adobe's Flash client, which sane people assumed couldn't be exploited, and exploited it with incredible style. Thomas Potacek did a great write-up on the paper, and I'll quote from it here. If you're not an exploit writer, think of it this way. You know that crazy version of Super Mario Brothers that Japan refused to ship to the US markets because they thought the difficulty would upset and provoke us? This is the exploit equivalent of that guy who played the perfect game of it on YouTube. Potacek also says Dowd's work is so advanced that his paper is proof Mark was manufactured by a malicious cluster of supercomputers inside Skynet instead of nurtured by loving human parents. So I think that means he's impressed. Anyway, Mark, a Sydney-sider who works for IBM ISS, joined me on the line last week to discuss his research.
Okay, well, the paper itself discusses a specific vulnerability in Flash, and basically it outlines the vulnerability itself, which is the null pointer type vulnerability, which you talked about, and it discusses, it discusses a exploitation technique for leveraging that vulnerability to gain, you know, reliable remote access to people's machines that are running Flash. But the reason there's a lot of attention drawn towards the paper is for two reasons. One is because Flash is really widely deployed, like it's available on, you know, Unix, Windows, Mac, and a range of embedded devices. And so a major vulnerability in Flash is a pretty big deal. But the other reason is that null pointer type vulnerabilities are generally not really, people don't really concentrate on them, like developers and security researchers have, except in a few specific cases, have sort of assumed that they're unexploitable for the most part. And that's not always the case, which is what this paper sort of illustrated.
Yeah, now I believe back in 2006, I'm looking at a little bit of a blurb here on uninformed.org. There was some research going into null pointer dereferences, but what you've done is taken it a step further, and it really is the method of exploitation that's got people excited here, isn't it?
Yeah, the thing in Uninformed was addressing a slightly different issue. There's been a number of papers and like investigations into null pointer dereferences in the past, and a lot of them have in the past have focused on basically operating system level vulnerabilities where you're able to get a valid page mapped at the base address of a process, and so basically any dereference from null will be exploitable or something. There was a few papers on that, the uninformed you mentioned, and there was also one specifically in the context of ARM processors that Barnaby Jack did
last year
or something.
I was actually going to get to that. That was a pretty big deal. That caused quite a stir in the area of embedded devices, because that's really what that one was about, right?
Yeah. So that was, he was basically outlining how in a lot of cases on embedded devices, you can exploit your standard null pointer dereference because there's a pretty important vector table mapped at that address. So what mine is basically what the vulnerability that I discovered was basically where a memory allocation failed, so a null pointer was returned, and the address written to wasn't null, it was null plus some offset, and that offset was more or less controllable by the user. And so when you add null with this valid and arbitrarily large offset, you can actually write to a valid region in memory, and often you can leverage that to execute arbitrary code or do whatever you want.
Now, I actually spoke to HD Moore earlier today. He's next week's guest on Risky Business, and he basically said to me that most people, when confronted with these sort of bugs, I mean, they're not really even going to look at figuring out how to exploit them, because it's a lot of hard work and you're never really going to be able to do it that successfully anyway. So what on earth possessed you to actually do this research that no one else seems to have got around to?
Well, basically it was a special case that I looked at, and at first it, you know, just seemed like a null pointer dereference, which usually just results in a crash, and which is not particularly exciting in the context of, you know, Flash. But I realized that the way the code was structured, you could actually write to a location other than null. And I used this information and went forward and said, okay, well, what could I do that would be useful here? And because I'd done a fairly extensive application review of Flash, I was aware of the workings of how the virtual machine worked quite intimately. So it was the first thing that occurred to me. I just thought, oh yeah, this would be really interesting attack to try, and I think it should work. And I tried it out, and it ended up working out. So it was basically because I had researched quite a lot of how the application worked already.
Now, in real terms, what are the implications of this research? I mean, you said before that Flash is very widely used. I mean, I believe in conversations I've had with Microsoft guys that Flash is actually the most commonly installed piece of software on the planet, because it ships with Windows, runs on Apple and Linux. I mean, it runs on absolutely everything. So, yeah, obviously a cross-platform exploitable. This is a cross-platform bug too, isn't it?
Yeah, it affects any system that has Flash installed. Basically, the software vulnerability itself is unrelated to the VM where the null pointer occurs. My exploitation methodology would work on a number of platforms with slight modification, but it really depends on the specifics of each platform. My paper specifically targeted Windows, but a similar style attack would likely to work out just fine on, you know, Mac and Linux, et cetera.
Work out just fine. I like that. Not if you're the owner of that machine.
Yeah.
But what was I going to ask? people are saying that this could mean that you've basically uncovered a separate class of vulnerability. Like, it might not or made a particular class of vulnerability more easy to exploit. I mean, are they hyping this up too much, or have you really opened up a bit of a can of worms with this stuff?
Well, I guess time will tell. The thing is, like, I didn't invent, like, null pointer dereference bugs or anything like that. If you look in the past, over the thousands of vulnerabilities that come out over the past couple of years, I'm sure you'll find a couple of instances of, like, null dereference type bugs. In fact, I even alluded to them in the book that I wrote several years ago, 2 years ago. But one of the interesting things is that, like we sort of mentioned before, very few developers and security researchers actually take the time to consider that they can be an exploitable bug rather than just breezing over it and either not noticing it or seeing it and going, yeah, that's just a crash at best. And from looking at other applications like since Flash, I think that there's this kind of bug is more common than people think, and it's likely that people are going to start paying attention to those conditions a lot more carefully when they're doing code reviews and stuff like that.
So do you think people are currently going back through old null pointer issues and trying to exploit them anew, given the knowledge that's sort of surfaced or bubbled through in your paper? Or
I mean, yeah, it's possible. Not just going back through old code, but, you know, having it at the forefront of your mind when you're looking at new applications as well. Whenever you come across a allocation that hasn't been, the return value hasn't been checked carefully, just looking at what happens immediately afterwards and seeing like whether there's a situation where you can actually write to a valid location in memory and cause something very bad to happen.
So we could see a flurry of pretty serious vulnerabilities sort of pop up because of this research, or?
Yeah, it's possible. It depends how many people pick it up and run with it. Like I sort of mentioned before, I've found in other applications similar problems since then, and they're in various stages of disclosure. But my impression is that there's quite a few of these vulnerabilities to be found, and it seems likely that over the rest of the year or however long, more of these types of bugs are going to start surfacing.
Yeah, now, one of the other things that I read in various analysis pieces based on your paper is that this blows away the myth that code written in really high-level languages like C# and whatnot can't be, can't have memory bugs. Can you walk us through the reasons why that's the case?
A lot of the discussion is valid and some of it is misplaced. Basically, the argument is that high-level languages such as Java and C# and all that can't have memory corruption style bugs because they basically don't allow you to manipulate memory directly. And that's true, right? But the problem is, or the thing that they're glossing over is that the virtual machine itself is written in the lower level language in most cases. And not only that, but they have native extensions. Basically, when you need the virtual machine to actually do something with the underlying system, such as, you know, open files or get access to devices or you know, whatever, there's often a native component underlying the virtual machine that it has to communicate with, and you end up having a native code being executed in a whole series of circumstances to basically request things from the system. So to say that memory corruption bugs don't exist in high-level languages is not exactly true, because you could find a vulnerability in the virtual machine itself or within one of these native extensions to the language. This is stuff that has been talked about before. And I mean, if you look back over vulnerabilities in the past, you know, there's been vulnerabilities in the Java virtual machine. There's been vulnerabilities in .NET not so long ago. So, like, it's known that you can get access to low-level vulnerabilities through these higher-level languages, but a lot of people just sort of sometimes tend to forget that.
I suppose you've just reminded them with a vengeance.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations again, Mark. It seems like you've done very well out of this one and got the kudos from all the right people. what next are you working on? Can we warn people?
I've got a couple of things lined up on my plate. At this stage, I'm probably going to be looking further into various protection mechanisms and stuff, specifically on the Windows platforms, the runtime protection mechanisms and stuff. And I'll probably be giving a talk on that kind of thing like later in the year, maybe Black Hat or something like that.
So you're about to make some guys in Redmond very unhappy?
They love it, really, you know.
They like it rough.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Mark Dowd, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thanks a lot.
That was Mark Dowd, vulnerability researcher with IBM ISS, on the line from Sydney. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now. RSA Security paid our bills this week, so today we're chatting with Greg Singh, an RSA sales engineer, about DLP. Now, all you tricky security elites out there say DLP is technology that isn't going to stop a determined attacker or a disgruntled insider from getting stuff to the outside. Well, surprisingly, RSA actually agrees with that, even though they're a DLP vendor. Greg Singh argues in this interview that DLP is more about preventing employees from accidentally leaking data.
Well, data loss prevention is a technology which can help you to classify your information in the first instance to understand where your sensitive information lives and how it evolves and grows within your network. So I'll define a little bit of that in a second. But then to track actually what's happening with that data by watching it at the gateway and various gateways within your environment. It doesn't need to be like the traditional, you know, link to the internet that we just watch. It also watches things such as the endpoint, which is the end user's computer, and other places that it might travel within the network. So the first thing that we do with DLP is we actually do the classification of the data to understand what is a sensitive piece of data. And we go looking for that data as it travels throughout the network.
Do you think DLP could be one of these things where the hype is greater than the actual usefulness that the product delivers in the end?
I think you need to understand what is the use case and what it's designed for, although it will definitely help you with situations of malicious activity, people trying to hack your data, etc. But really what it's really looking for is people who are making mistakes in their jobs and people who are just doing their day-to-day business, and perhaps they sent information that shouldn't go to a particular user or outside of the company's policy to that particular user, or they were transferring data onto a memory stick just so they could load it up on their home PC and work on that Excel spreadsheet overnight.
So the pitch is actually making a lot more sense when you put it like that, that it's really about, you know, that sort of passive leakage rather than, you know, uber cool Chinese government sponsored spear phishing attacks.
Absolutely.
On your CFO, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, the technology is really designed around trying to keep some parameters around what the day-to-day user is doing. Ways that people use systems at the moment is quite often people walk around security mechanisms. They'll say to people, look, I can't receive that encrypted document, or I can't receive that type of document. Can you send it to my Gmail account? Okay, and then I can log on and get it from my Gmail account or my Hotmail account. That sort of thing is so common these days. And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to stop that type of behavior. We're trying to stop those mechanisms where people are just trying to get things done. They can see easy ways to do it. And indeed, there's proper process that can be put in place to achieve the goal that they want, but maybe just not in the way in which they're doing it.
Now, it's sort of like a reverse network-based IDS in that really you've got a border device that's going to try to stop stuff from going out. I mean, that's one approach. And then there's also the approach which is to use the host-based stuff, which is supposed to monitor what's going on to, you know, USB keys and things like that. I would have thought that rolling out an endpoint agent onto every single system in your, you know, environment is going to be a real management headache. Are you anticipating much growth in host-based DLP, or do you think that one's going to sort of wash out, I guess?
Yeah, there's definitely different parts of the solution. So, I mean, organizations can choose to say, look, I'm just going to put it at the gateway because it's so much easier just to put an appliance in. I don't need to touch any of my workstations. But in saying that, there's a lot of different types of desktop environments out there. Many of them are based on technologies such as Windows. These sorts of packages deploy in a very similar way to what you will deploy normal MSI type packages, where you can deploy them through standard SMS or group policy type mechanisms. So they're not particularly difficult to push out. They're not particularly difficult to administer. You do need to have a reasonably healthy network to make that all operate. Most organizations that we deal with that are interested in this type of technology do have such an infrastructure. It then just becomes a question of, do they really want to look for leakage at the endpoint, which is usually the user's laptop?
Yeah, yeah. Now, are they hungry agents as well, these things?
They're not particularly hungry agents. They're something of a mid-range, I'd say, and probably something you might think is synonymous with something like a virus scanner or something, because it's doing a similar type of activity in looking for particular types of data or particular fingerprints of data.
It's looking for strings, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, string is one method by which it operates, but it can actually look at doing like a hashing type of operation on a document and will look for that hash. So instead of looking for the whole of War and Peace, as a string or a piece of information within the text, we're actually looking for a representation of that text as a cryptographic operation. It does have the ability to look at the information either as a whole document or as a subset of that document.
So it can actually just look for certain blocks of text? Or
It can indeed look for certain blocks of text.
Rightio. Now, you mentioned earlier the laptop angle, that the leakage often comes from laptops. Why is that?
Well, I think, I mean, most traditionally people were looking at the gateway as being the point of transit for information in and out of the network, which is typically the router or the firewall, which is the general connection. But these days people are picking up a laptop more often than not, as desktop bound machines become less popular these days, and people walk straight out the door with their laptop. So imported information that could have been on a database or a server can just be copied or replicated to your laptop and you can walk straight out the door with it. And for that reason, we're finding that there is more interest in DLP at the endpoint to make sure that people don't just go outside and then burn a heap of information to a CD, for instance, and then just pass it off or put it in their home computer, and maybe their home computer is the subject of a virus or a hacker attack. There are ways around things, but we're trying to make sure that we've got a reasonable control, a reasonable vision over what's happening. And for those things that people found to be easy, where they could just get things sent to their Hotmail or their Gmail or whatever, we're trying to make that process a lot more difficult for them, to discourage them from such activities.
So I guess DLP in this world is not so much a big brother type of solution, but more a friendly auntie type of solution.
Yeah, that's probably not a bad scenario.
All right, Greg, well, thanks a lot for coming on to Risky Business this week.
All the best. Thank you for your time. Can I get what I
want? Can I do as I choose? And that's it for this edition of Risky Business. This week's Sound Foundation track is Sarah McGregor singing Into You. And don't forget, you can buy this track as a DRM-free MP3 from soundfoundation.com.au for $1.40. If you like this show, you might want to tune into A Series of Tubes. That's the other podcast I do here on itradio.com.au, and that updates every Thursday. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. I prayed you would arrive. I know it's kind of early, but I think that we'll survive my fine new friend. Be bold, do you wanna be brave? Is it time to be good? Have you got what it takes? Can I get what I want? Can I do as I choose? Oh, I'm so into you. Oh, I'm so into you. Now that you've opened the door, I find myself wanting more. I'm taking a chance to be sure. Oh.